If you don't like capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what do you want?
And there is a great deal of new construction of new institutions, new forms, new cooperatives, new worker-owned companies that's happening all over the country.
This is the Gar Alperovitz Podcast, a regular look at the ideas of historian and political economist Gar Alperovitz as he explores strategies to democratize wealth and empower workers and communities.
My name is Maliha Safri, and you all are here at Workplace Democracy and Democratic Ownership, Moving from Theory to Strategy. And to my right is our Richard Wolf and Gar Alperovitz. I'll introduce them in just a second. This panel is about one of the most pressing issues. What does economic democracy look like? What does it look like at the very on-the-ground level when you work in a place that you could or would consider democratic? How is it different? How does it feel different? How does it make you act differently? These are important questions. Some might consider them related to the issue of subjectivity. But in addition to that, we have other important differences. How would such a workplace be related to the material aspects of your life? Would you be better off? Would you have more job stability? Last summer, I visited a pretty large workplace, a worker collective that could be considered as characterized by workplace democracy. And they produce washing machines. We're in the middle of a serious economic crisis. The demand for washing machines has fallen along with all white appliances, especially since housing sales have slumped, right? So one of the interesting things is while they're selling less washing machines for the last 2 years, all of the workers, around 2,500 workers, got together and decided to take a 7.5% pay cut so that all of the jobs would be preserved for everyone in that workplace. And now that's fascinating. We could spend a lot of time thinking, talking about that, and it's very easy to dive into. But I think we also have to zoom out from that micro level, right? And that's what our two speakers are here to help us do today. How do you zoom out and think about maintaining, building conditions that would support such workplaces and communities? What kinds of supporting institutions do we need? What kind of middle and, let's say, upper level, or using the lens of political economy, what kind of meso, macro institutions, governments would we need to have these kinds of workplaces? So first, I'll introduce Gar. Gar Alperovitz is the author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution, 2013. And 2011 book, America Beyond Capitalism. I believe this one's outside, if you want to take a look at it. Gar's work, the trouble with these two kind of guys is we could be here all day talking about what it is that they've done during their lifetimes. So I'll just stick to the last 5-10 years. So Gar's work has been really important on the Evergreen projects in Cleveland. Incredible pioneering project in the United States that has become the example par excellence of worker collective cooperative complexes that seek to emulate some of the institutional networks of Mondragon in Spain. Worker cooperatives and all of the, let's say, UW center developers in University of Wisconsin, there's a big center for cooperatives. Such kinds of experiences don't fare very well in isolation. They work better with partner organizations, worker centers, universities, And Gar has been very important in pioneering this experience called the Democracy Collaborative, also a sponsor of this panel. And that collaborative partnered with a lot of institutions in Cleveland to produce this series of experiences. And it's paying off. There are sister projects in Atlanta, Pittsburgh, Washington, D.C., Amarillo, Texas, the most recent one in Springfield, Massachusetts, where they've raised about $250,000 for the exact same kind of model. And of course, he has a long history of activism going back to the U.S. steelworkers in Youngstown, an experience that he writes of in this most recent book. Richard Wolff is professor emeritus at UMass Amherst in the economics department. He is now at the School of International Affairs at the New School. His latest book is Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. This is upstairs in the book room. It's one of three books he published last year. The other one, Contending Economic Theories, and the third one, Occupy the Economy. Now, that level of productivity is impressive and slightly panic-inducing, I think. We all feel a little bit bad because that's not all he does, right? Rick, along with Steve Resnick, the late Steve Resnick, spent the last 30 years building a very sophisticated take on Marxian economic theory, building the most unique, probably, economics grad student in the U.S. I understand, I'm a little biased. I was a student there. This involved going back to Marxian texts to define a surplus-based approach to the economy. He was a wildly popular professor to undergraduate and graduate students. In 2008, he turned his attention a little bit more squarely to popularizing his this body of work, as well as to spreading resistance movements in the U.S., Greece, and elsewhere, groups and movements that question the forced austerity programs in the face of record-breaking profits in the U.S. in 2011 and 2012. Rick was in the thick of things, still is, speaking to Occupy protesters in New York, teaching a popular monthly class at the Brecht Forum. Also, he's a board member there. Speaking with Syriza party delegations, visiting with Greek and Spanish social movements, and I know I'm missing a lot of, so I'll stop there. And please welcome our two speakers.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Maliha, for a generous introduction. And I'm very glad to be here. Before I tell you what exactly I want to talk about, I want to give a broader framework for the kind of work that I understand GAR to be doing, and that I'm doing, and that others like us are doing. I think we are at an extraordinary historical time. I know you hear that from time to time, but I really do mean that. I don't believe that about a lot of other times, but I do believe it about now. I didn't even believe it about the situation we're in now as little as 3 or 4 years ago, but I am now persuaded of the following, that capitalism as a system has shifted in a profound way that I think is worth putting as the context for what I have to say. For the first 200 years, roughly, of capitalism's history, maybe 250 years, up till around the 1970s. It was a system that concentrated the good news that it has to offer. Technological innovation, rising real wages, decade after decade. It concentrated those benefits, if you like, in North America, Western Europe, and perhaps Japan. And it made most of the rest of the world accept the bad news of capitalism, the extraction of raw materials and minerals at enormous social and human cost, the subordination of economic development to be a poor adjunct to what was the good news in North America, Western Europe, and Japan. Then around the 1970s, and of course it's not just then, but to make the point, around the 1970s, global capitalism changed. It responded to its own history. Capitalist enterprises that for 150 to 200 years had focused on North America, Western Europe, and Japan had had to struggle with their trade unions and their socialist and communist parties, had in the course of events had to raise wages for a variety of reasons, now discovered that with the benefit of modern high-speed jet transportation and the internet and telecommunications, they could do something that hadn't been feasible before. That the ironic opportunity presented to them by the decimation of the third world was transformed into an opportunity. Even the independent struggles of the third world helped create the opportunity. And that opportunity can be described as follows. In China, in India, in Brazil, and all the others, there was a desperation to escape the horrors of what global capitalism had meant for them. They invited the big capitalists of the North to come, and they offered them unspeakably cheap wages, easy government support, absence of costly regulations, all the rest. And with the internet and high-speed travel, it was possible to command and control enterprises in the third world from your base in New York or Chicago about as easily as you could do it before. And so the American capitalist class and the European capitalist class and the Japanese undertook a massive relocation of production from the high-cost areas of its birth to the low-cost desperado locations that it had economically ravaged for a century or two. First it was manufacturing, and then it was white-collar jobs. Until now, almost everything is up for grabs. And here's the point. Capitalism is booming. That's what the stock market explosions mean of the last 35 years. That's what the rapid recovery of the U.S. stock market means now. Profits are booming, but their profits increasingly located from manufacturing elsewhere, from white-collar jobs elsewhere, and then the final step, from the focus of marketing, advertising of all kinds, government money provided by corporations is now money provided in India and China and Brazil and elsewhere, because that's where the market is growing. The American corporation that used to give money to an American university is now giving that money to a Chinese university, because that's where they want their future employees to be coming from, because that's where their focus is. Americans, Europeans, and Japanese are discovering that the capitalism that gave them a special position is the same capitalism that can take it away and confront them with the prospect that we will only come back to the areas of our origin when you make it as profitable for us to stay as it now is for us to leave. Capitalism no longer delivers the goods in the West. It delivers the bads more and more, whether it's the absurd debt that the new generation of college students has to take on before they can get a degree, whether it's the wasted cities, the spectacle of a Detroit that decade after decade wallows in the absurdity that are now reaching absolute comic proportions with the receiver of the city, or Camden, New Jersey, or fill in the blank. Therefore, I believe, with or without this crisis, during it now or when it ends, the prospect for the American people, for sure, is a long-term economic decline, confronting them with questions about capitalism they never thought they would have to ask. And that gives us the greatest opportunity for a movement of the left to fundamentally alter things that we have had since the last great collapse of capitalism in the 1930s. And we can already see the signs, whether it's the attention that Gar's work gets or the attention that I get. We both of us understand. This has very little to do with us. We've been singing pretty much this song quite a while. What has changed is not the song or how we sing it. It's the American audience that suddenly finds this music interesting. And so we have opportunities we didn't have before. It is a historic moment. Capitalism is in question. Capitalism, the system, isn't so clearly what's best for America. When I go around the country and end my talks with the remark, "We can do better than capitalism," people have a big, fat smile on their faces. I've said the naughty thing, and they're not at risk because I said it. So they can just enjoy it. It's a little bit like a Richard Pryor concert. You wouldn't dare say those things, but you sure love it that he's doing that. So I understand the situation. But it is a historic moment. And the question is now in America, not so much what's wrong with capitalism. They don't need us for that anymore. Their own lives are teaching them that. But what they do need and what we need to supply is, what do we do now? Where do we go? Or to paraphrase one of the great leaders of our effort, what is to be done? What is to be done? And what answer do we give? Well, I'm going to be blunt in the interest of time. We cannot give the traditional socialist and communist answer. We can't. For two reasons. One, a lot of things went wrong in those early efforts to build an alternative to capitalism. They went wrong. That has to be faced. That has to be understood. We have to figure that out. But here in the United States, we have a second reason, even more important, which is we have half a century of endlessly battering our people with an image of socialism and communism that make them so horrific, so unattractive, so awful, that whatever the reality was, most Americans really don't know. But they do have a clear idea of what the image is that we're supposed to have, and that makes those things impossible at this moment as alternatives. So between the flaws that actually existed in traditional socialism and communism, and they're serious, and the image of those two in the American and European mentality, we have a serious problem. How do we make an advance in that set of circumstances to take advantage of the unique historical situation I tried to summarize? And I think Gar and I, separately, I mean, we know each other, we've worked together, but really separately, have arrived at something that strikes both of us. I'm not going to speak for Gar, obviously, he will in a minute. But I think we share a sense of a major way forward. I call this a kind of worker co-op movement. And so let me briefly explain what I mean. That we depart from traditional socialism and communism in a very important way. Our focus is not primarily macroeconomic. Mine is not macroeconomic. I am not wrapped up with moving from private property to nationalized or socialized property. I am not primarily excited about moving from markets to planning. Traditional communism and socialism have focused on those two things, the socialization of productive property and the transition from markets to planning. Those are macro-level changes. I think they left untouched, or at least put it this way, they left unchanged the micro level. What actually happens in the store, in the office, in the factory. If you don't pay attention to that, you run the following risk. You get rid of the private board of directors selected by the major shareholders, and you substitute government officials. But that may mean that you end up having the workers come to work every day working in the same way, with the same machine, the same corner of the factory, producing the same goods, and leaving at the end of the day exactly as they did before, but the board of directors are 16 officials rather than 16 privately elected directors. And if you distribute the resources and the goods in society by means of planners working in the capital, It's not clear how much difference that makes in your life compared to what was done before when these goods were sold in a quid pro quo exchange in the market. It leaves very little change in the daily life of work. So, our focus is that was the missing element. That's one of the major reasons why the revolutions to start socialism and communism, where they happened, were unable to succeed, even to maintain themselves, whatever you think of them. They couldn't survive. And one of the arguments and criticisms of them were they were top-down, they weren't democratic, they weren't controlled from the base. Yeah, but it's the base, precisely, that you didn't change. It's the organization of the enterprise that you left largely unchanged, at least relative to the changes you made at the macro level. So the idea is to redefine what socialism might mean, whether or not you use the word. And to redefine it by saying, whatever the changes at the macro level, this time we're not going to forget or overlook or minimize or marginalize a transformation at the micro level, at the base. We're going to transform the enterprise. Not in some future time when socialism is more secure. No, no, no. Right now. Right as the central point. And what is meant by this is a radical democratization, if you like. If the word democracy still remains so delicious in your mouth, use it. Democratize the enterprise. What does it mean? That the workers become collectively their own board of directors. That's the role currently occupied by capitalists. They will be removed from that role. They will be replaced by the workers collectively deciding what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the net revenues of the enterprise. Store, factory, office. By net revenues, I'm trying to use a friendly English. The word, of course, that I'm looking for is the surplus. The workers become their own board of directors. The awkward phrase I have come to rely on, workers' self-directed enterprises. That the revolution now means that. Whatever it means at the macro level in terms of property ownership, markets, and planning, it is going to have to also include the radical transformation of the enterprise. Because the alternative is to recapitulate the last century, and we don't want to do that. Now, in the time I have left, I have to make a difficult choice. Make more arguments about why it's a good idea. I don't really want to. Talk about the complexity. Well, I've done it so often. So I'm going to try to do it a little bit differently in what time remains to me. I'm going to try to make a case with you. Argue about what some of the concrete benefits, if you like, are from doing this. Because I would do that in a larger audience where I get the chance. I don't know whether the Bill Moyers program, which is re-airing his interview with me this weekend, whether it concentrates on the first of my two interviews with him or the second. If it concentrates on the second, then what I'm doing now is a little bit like what goes on in that interview. By the way, footnote, Bill Moyers created that opportunity for us and is a very sympathetic to what it is I'm saying. If we had enterprises that were worker self-directed, the workers collectively made the decisions now in the hands of capitalist enterprises, here are some of the consequences I think we can point to and that we could use in building the political support for this. First, I put on my hat as an economist. The single most important factor in shaping the inequality of income and wealth in a capitalist society has to do with the distribution of the surplus. That's always been true. The workers produce a surplus over and above what they get. That is in the hands of capitalists, and how those capitalists distribute that surplus shapes the distribution of income and wealth. If workers made that decision themselves, and that's what workers becoming their own directors means, here are some of the things that would and would not happen. Would you give a wildly disproportionate share of the surplus to a handful of top executives in the manner of how we pay CEOs today? No chance. Number two, would you distribute the same proportion of the surplus you get today in dividends to shareholders? It's not even clear there'd be any shareholders, and even if there were, the chances of your distributing a major share to them, very small. Number three, would the workers collectively distribute an enormous amount of that surplus to the professional staffs of large corporations, the way they are distributed now? Legal staff, architectural staff, major consultant, strategic staff, people with one, two, three, or more MBAs, etc. I don't think so. Four, would they distribute to an army of middle managers, or the more accurate term, supervisors? Or would you imagine that the workers might imagine you could save an awful lot by supervising ourselves, which they would have every interest in doing since they are now the people who run the enterprise? I think it's safe to say that on all of those four counts, or at least on most of them, a worker self-directed enterprise would behave radically differently from the way a capitalist enterprise does. Or to say the same thing as bluntly as I know how, a worker self-directed enterprise would never distribute the surplus of the enterprise it now directs in a manner as unequal as has been the norm in capitalist society. Or to say the same thing yet another way, after all the, and let's be honest, failed efforts to overcome the inequality of wealth and income characteristic of capitalism, the anti-poverty campaigns, the laws, the progressive tax structure, and none of them have worked. This is the way to do that. The transformation of enterprises is the best structural assault on inequality that is imaginable. Those of you that know the Mondragon system in Spain will know that, depending on which official there you speak to, and I've spoken to a few, the range between the top and the bottom salary is somewhere between 6.5 and 8.5. The norm in the United States in major corporations is on the order of 300 or 400 to 1. So you have a practical example of what is possible over a sustained period. Mondragon's been around over half a century. What is possible in a successfully growing enterprise, as Mondragon has shown itself to be, what is possible with a much narrower inequality than anything a modern capitalism can point to. Number two, I think worker self-directed enterprises would react differently to the problem of ecology and environmental degradation. And here I would make a simple point, but I think crucial here. When workers who are their own directors confront a classic situation, they will react differently. Here's the classic situation. A new technology comes available. It improves the profitability of the enterprise, but at the cost of polluting something, the air, the water, the ground. The corporate heads sitting usually far away, way, because they are members of Earth First, they weigh the profit gain, which they want, against the ecological degradation, which they abhor, particularly while in church. Okay? And after a serious anguish, they opt to to go the direction of more profit because, you know, competition being what it is. And they are not unmindful of the fact that since they control the surplus, they can give themselves the kinds of salaries and bonuses and perks that will allow them to escape from the very pollution their choice of technology entails. Now switch. Imagine the workers in the enterprise making the same decision. They're now there. They run the enterprise. We have revolutionized, democratized the enterprise. They also will weigh the benefits of a profit increase. It's important to them, too. But they will also weigh the environmental degradation that they will have to drink or breathe or live on, and so will their parents and their children and their neighbors and their communities, and they're going to evaluate that trade-off very differently because they can't escape. And so we're going to get a different pattern of decisions. And that's the point, after all, a different pattern of decisions. So there's an argument for worker self-directed enterprise. Next one. This is easy. You think the workers, if they were their own directors, will sit around and decide, more profitable to produce in China, we'll close the business here and we'll go to China. It's unlikely. Self-destruction of your job is not a usual desideratum of American workers or of anybody else. You want an assault on runaway shops? Here's how you do it. What do all these things have in common? A simple idea. If you want the economic system to work for the people, you got to put them in charge of the enterprises. Otherwise, you're not serious, are you? I have 1 minute left. Let me go this way. Some questions. Gee, if the workers were in charge, they might pay themselves more. Absolutely right. Probably will. Let me give you an example of how that works. I'm going to compare Walmart, a store you all know and I'm sure go to every other day, okay, and another one called Costco. It's an interesting comparison. Average wage at Walmart's about $12 an hour. Average wage at Costco, $20 an hour. What the hell's going on? Costco, from the beginning, has paid its workers much better than Walmart. Costco is the seventh largest retailer in the world, is just as profitable as Walmart, maybe more so, and sometimes for sure more so. Is it possible to pay your workers more and to make a success in a capitalist world? Absolutely. The top executive of Costco gets a salary in the hundreds of thousands, which makes him very badly paid by comparison to what those folks usually get. There you go. That's what workers who ran a business themselves, that's what they would do as a matter of course. It wouldn't be necessary for me to pull out Costco as an example because it would become the norm. Okay, last point, promise. Last point. Politics. You're all interested in politics. How would workers taking over the enterprise change politics? Well, this goes to the way I begin. Today in the United States, the federal government relies for its tax income, for its money income, on taxing individuals for their income and taxing corporations on their profits, their net income. That's where bulk of the money for the federal government comes from. If workers took over the enterprise, we'd have for the first time something new. The government would depend on workers for the individual income tax, but it would have to depend on workers for the enterprise tax too. It would just have to depend on workers as they're in their capacity as individuals and in their capacity as directors of enterprises. And the government dependent on workers, what an interesting idea. That would mean the government was dependent on the majority. That's another interesting idea. That would mean an actual structuralization, a structural basis for democracy about which we talk endlessly in this country, but about which we don't do much. By way of conclusion, there is something remarkable about the United States endlessly proclaiming itself democratic, justifying the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in the name of building or bringing democracy. It's endless. And then you realize you're in a society which has always exempted one area from any such requirement. Work. You enter the store, you enter the factory, you enter the office, and you give up as a worker all of that. You live with all the decisions that are made in your workplace, but you participate in none of them. They're all made by somebody else, a tiny group making the decisions for a majority. And what is the workplace? I don't know. It's the place you go 5 days a week out of seven, from 9 to 5. It's the single most important place you occupy in your life as an adult. What an interesting commitment to democracy that exempts the place where you spend most of your life. That's a commitment to democracy that is hollow. And that wouldn't be the worst of it. But the social consequences that we're now living through suggest that a transition to a radically different way of organizing enterprises is long overdue and is the best shot we have now for a radical change in the direction of our societies at a time where, if this isn't done, the decline confronting our populations will have catastrophic social consequences. Thank you very much.
That was great. Richard and I are on very much a converging path. We have some differences, but at this point, what we care about and what we support and what we are urging is far more important than the differences. So let me say a couple things just at the outset by way of framing in a way that takes off, but is slightly different from the framing argument that Richard presented. And this I want to focus on the United States and the nature of the emerging crisis that we are facing and why it offers opportunity for the kinds of strategies that both he and I endorse and affirm. So, and I think it's critical that we talk about it in this terms. The traditional Marxist crisis collapse presumed a revolution after a crisis collapse. The traditional liberal reform strategy was there would not be a crisis, but labor would enforce a social democratic solution in capitalism. We call it liberalism, in which you can tax, reform, manage the economy, and achieve a high growth rate in the manner of John Kenneth Galbraith, if you like. But not a crisis. That was the reform strategy rather than a revolutionary strategy. We are talking about a strategic possibility that opens up the way to slow and steady evolution, which may or may not achieve a different, more explosive change later, but that the context in which we're working permits and encourages strategies of the kind he described and the kind I'm going to describe shortly. And briefly, if a system does not collapse, and why the United States is probably not likely to achieve the big collapse that was always forecast, the U.S. economy now has government at the rate of 32 to 35% of the economy, depending upon the denominator of the fraction, recession, or boom. In 1929, it was 11%. There is a significant floor under the system, and even in times of great difficulty, the corporate leadership and the Bush administration, which was pushing economic stimulus, and the Ronald Reagan's chief advisors were asking for more stimulus because they didn't want the system to totally collapse. And probably they can prevent that collapse. George Bush's famous line is, I'm not going to let this sucker go down. That was his phrasing because he knew the consequences, and more important, the floor was higher. On the other hand, the traditional labor strategy totally depended both in Europe and in the United States on a strong labor union base. American labor unions have gone from 35.4% of the labor force as members down now to less than 11% and less than 6% in the private sector and declining. The entire institutional muscle of that system of reform that dominated the mid-third of the 20th century is in decay. So the system, and if I had time, I'd give you a longer discussion of this, consider the possibility that the system neither collapses in the traditional way nor reforms in the traditional way. It's in that context that we are seeing people realize slowly and steadily that something quite fundamental is wrong and does not get corrected. And we're also seeing, and this is the significant point, out of the pain that that produces at the local level, almost entirely ignored by the press, which is one, not interested, two, financially stressed, 3 run by corporate interests, and 4 never interested in the localities. At the local level, there's an explosion of developments, all of which are characterized in one form or another, and I'll give you some more examples, by the democratization of the ownership of wealth in one form or another. So I'll give you some discussion of that. And then there are very interesting experiments developing and exploding around the country that push the envelope further on things like worker self-control, worker management, worker ownership, planning, et cetera, bank changeovers, credit union changeovers, changing who owns capital, changing who owns land, democratizing, et cetera. So if you stand back from this, where you see an emerging crisis of ideology, it isn't the case that people are frightened. Here's where Richard and I differ on this very small point. People aren't frightened of the word socialism anymore. If you act, the latest polls show that people under 30 who will create the next politics, who else, slightly favor the term socialism over the term capitalism. And the last 3 polls have been a wash, and they've been moving slowly towards favoring the term socialism. The press doesn't report much of that, but that was the latest Rasmussen poll on this. So there is openness even to the language of socialism, and certainly to the concepts and the practicalities that we are beginning to see on the ground. Let me tell you, just to give you a sense of some of the other things, it is not solely what's happening within the firm, though I agree entirely with worker control and worker ownership, and some additions to that, which I'll come to shortly. Around the country, 130 million Americans, another term for what Richard's talking about is a cooperative, there are 130 million Americans today who are members of cooperatives. A lot of those in credit unions, which is a one-person, one-vote bank, and the credit unions taken together have as much capital as any one of the big 5 New York banks. And there is activism attempting to take over and use credit unions for different purposes. Those are democratic banks, potentially of great power. Nobody goes to the board meetings. They're quite stagnant in most parts of the country. You can go to the board meeting, sign up as a member, and indeed in several parts of the country, people are electing new people, new blood for that institution, trying to turn it around and use it in a different way. From Jackson, Mississippi, there are interesting examples. Of using the funding to provide money for new kinds of cooperatives of this kind, et cetera, et cetera. You don't hear that in the press. You have to dig and find it. But there are 130 million people who are in one way or another involved. There are some 10 million people involved in different forms of worker ownership, mainly out of the ESOP process, some of those becoming democratized, many of them becoming unionized, and some of them pointing in the direction. There are 3 million more people involved in worker-owned companies already than are members of unions in the private sector. There is an internal discussion and development for more and more participation and control in that structure. Socialization of land is increasing, and again, you don't find it in the press. What this is often called is the land trust. What is a land trust? You draw a circle around land in a large geographic area. You either socialize it, the city owns it, or you socialize it by establishing a nonprofit neighborhood-controlled corporation. The neighborhood owns and controls it. It's a way to prevent gentrification, turn the profits of development towards community services, like offsetting costs of housing for low-income communities. It is a very radical way to take over land, and it is growing around the country. 30 years ago, there were 2, one in southwest Georgia, one in Vermont. There are now hundreds. Irvine, California has 5,000 units of housing in that form of land transformation. There is a fight to take over utilities. There are 16 utilities that have been taken over by municipalities already in the last 20 years. There is a whole development going on in trying to take over the internet part of the utilities. 350 communities are doing socialized internet. This is what's going on that probably is not reported, all of which characterized by who gets to own the land, the internet, the worker-owned companies, by democratizing capital in various different ways. There is 20 states are now trying to replicate the Bank of North Dakota, which is a socialist bank, been there for 90 years, nobody noticed it. All of a sudden, people have begun to notice it. Washington is the most farthest along. Oregon is probably going to be next. There are several cities looking to use city deposits There's an entire public banking movement going on to use city deposits to create the basis of a city-owned bank. In other words, a socializing the bank structure. Several cities are doing that. Something is brewing in many, many quarters, all of which is characterized not only in terms of worker management and self-management and ownership, but the larger question, too, of democratic ownership of different pieces of the economic system. Let me give you a couple others for the couple others that are in development. The healthcare system, almost 20%, almost a fifth of the economy, is in dire straits in terms of cost problems, in terms of structure, in terms of inclusiveness. It is almost certain to create more and more problems as corporations try to throw people out of it through what's called skinny insurance, cutting it way down or taking the penalties that they pay and then getting people off the rolls. In specific states, the rubber hits the road in the states. 20 states have introduced legislation for single payer. Vermont will achieve it next year. California did twice, passed single payer, not because they only want it, but because the pressures are growing and are likely to continue to grow. What is single payer? It's a public insurance company. Public, that's what Medicare is, a socialized insurance company. You can see state by state by state, that process is almost certain to take over and transform the ownership structures in many, many states in this emergent context of neither collapse nor reform. So there's another piece of the puzzle that's developing, which points towards a fifth of the economy. Those of you who are watching the banking sector, and I'm trying to give a whole picture of what is emerging that we haven't paid close attention to. If you watch the banking sector, experts left, right, and center now agree there will be more banking crises. They are back to doing what they've been doing all along. They are bigger now than they were before. And when the next crisis comes, or the one after that, almost certainly the liberal response will be, break them up. That's the current nostrum. And I suspect at some point they'll do that. And then they will regroup, as the big fish will eat the little fish, and they'll be back at the trough again. At some point down that line, I suspect a real nationalization process will be possible. We almost did it in terms of de facto nationalization and gave it back. We had enough capital in many of those banks, public banks, that could have been taken over and nationalized, and de facto they were. AIG, people sometimes think nationalization piece by piece by piece is not possible. You may have noticed we did, in fact, nationalize General Motors, AIG, and to a certain degree, Chrysler. As the crisis builds up and this kind of thing happens in future, my judgment is at some point, instead of giving them back, we may keep them and start making mass transit or high-speed rail and turning them into worker public corporations of a large kind. If I had time, I'd sketch out why I think we're beginning to see an evolutionary development which begins to offer many different ways to the simple notion of who gets the capital begins to be a public debate question at many, many levels. Let me turn back to the worker ownership question itself. I see these various developments as compatible with, supportive of, and potentially integratable with the developments that Richard's talking about. But I think they are critical to build a mass movement that has other elements than simply what goes on in the firm. And there are also some problems that need to be dealt with regard to the model, the well-known problems that Richard, I'm sure, has thought as much about it as I have. I first came across this working with steelworkers in 1977, a long time ago. That was in Youngstown, Ohio, the first major collapse of a giant steel industry, Youngstown Sheet and Tube collapse. 5,000 people lost their jobs in one day. That was news, front page news, television front page news, all over the country, all over the world in 1977. It hadn't happened. Now it's so common that nobody pays attention anymore. But in that particular situation, the steelworkers took the lead and said, why don't we take over this company? Why don't we run it ourselves? But also, it is of such significance to the larger community, this came from the steelworkers, that it ought to be structured in a way that includes the community as a whole as well. So the proposal they made, and which became the part and parcel of what they were trying to do, was for a community worker balance of some kind that would own and control the mill. Now, what happens in that situation is interesting, because one of the problems that begin, if you can do that, I'll give you a short view of what happened after that. But notice, if you are a worker-owned company and you find that you are in competition with another worker-owned company in the steel industry, and another one down the road. And you may not want to pollute your neighborhood. But if they do it over there and can cut costs radically, and you haven't found a way to organize across sectors, which is very hard to do, they will wipe you out. Any worker-owned company in the market facing other worker-owned companies who begin to violate the violate the standards and can cut costs will destroy you. And you are forced to do what they do, or the situation gets worse. Community-wide structures internalize externalities. They present larger problems at the national level, but they begin to address that structural issue. My own view is we're going to see a mix of worker-owned companies and slash worker community-owned companies at different levels, depending upon scale and depending upon circumstances. And another problem we have to face is that the worker-owned companies we've seen in this country so far, the famous plywood companies in the Northwest, didn't produce socialist ideology. They produced conservative Republicans. The internal structures produced people who wanted to get more for themselves. So building a whole larger culture of what this is all about is critical to the development of the vision that he and I share, and that I'm sure most people in this audience share. There's another problem that we've begun to see developing, and there are some very interesting solutions beginning to emerge. You mentioned earlier the Cleveland experiments that we're working on in Cleveland, Ohio. The Democracy Collaborative has been heavily involved in Cleveland. So let me give you a structure of what's on the ground now, and then talk about some of the things that we think it teaches and need development further. And again, and here's the point, can now be done in the prehistory in which we live of potentially the next American Revolution. Think the prehistory of the New Deal, where labor law was developed state by state by state, and then when the moment had arrived and when enough power had been accumulated and enough ideas had been organized, a developmental thrust can go forward in a different way. Think the prehistory of the American feminist drive in the 19th century, state by agonizing state by agonizing state by agonizing state, laying groundwork and then transforming. And the transformation may be of a different and more explosive kind, but laying down the experience and building now forward so that the new elements are actually representative and more democratized when we get there. I totally agree with Richard on that point. Here's the model in Cleveland, and note the outlines of it and what it might suggest about where we might go around the country. And many, many other cities are doing something very similar to this because there is no answer at the local level. The crisis at the local level forces people to say we either do nothing or something new. We've tried to get benefits for small business. It doesn't work. We try to get the corporations in. What happens if we bribe them for $100,000 a job or $200,000 a job? That's the going price in terms of tax bribes. You want a corporation to come in, it's $100,000 to $200,000 per job that you have to pay, and then they leave in 6 to 7 years. That doesn't work. So what you get is deepening crisis in many of these cities, Cleveland being one, Detroit being another, St. Louis being a number, you name it. In Cleveland, for complex reasons, which we can go into if you like, but in any case, there is an emergent model which has the following characteristics. Worker-owned and self-directed companies, that's what Richard's talking about, and they are linked together in the Mondragon style, but now geographically oriented to the community as a whole. So they're linked together with a nonprofit corporation. They cannot be sold off and run away. They cannot be sold off to become independent players. And secondly, by definition, they have to kick back to the community building side of that effort, some part of their profits. And another part goes into a revolving fund, very Mondragon-based, in fact, directly Mondragon-based, the notion of which is to help spin off build new and new, more and more worker-owned companies. That's the structure. Geographic community as the steelworkers had it, and now in this community, using a mixed joint venture of community building and worker-owned cooperatives. That's the larger structure, which aims at expanding and developing and building out. Now, this is in a part of Cleveland, 40,000 neighborhood, unemployment, mostly black, unemployment 40%, average family income 18,000. So that's one feature that takes it beyond standard worker ownership in the marketplace. A second feature is that in the middle of that particular neighborhood, this is true all over the country, by the way, many, many, many cities have these characteristics and they're picking up on what it means, are big institutions, hospitals, universities, particularly, and other public institutions. Cleveland Clinic is there, one of the largest world clinics in the world. Case Western Reserve University is there. University Hospital is there. Those three institutions alone, and this is true in many parts of the country, purchase $3 billion, with a B, dollars in goods and services a year, mostly financed with taxpayer money, Medicare, Medicaid, educational money, none of which went to this neighborhood. Zero. Now, that $3 billion, in addition, there were jobs and salaries. That's leaving that out. In addition, construction, leaving that out. Just what they buy. So the notion that developed was, why not begin to target some of that purchasing power from institutions that have a public base and are a quasi-public market? I'm sketching for you a decentralized planning system, those of you who watch closely, a quasi-public market to stabilize the market of these worker-owned companies in this complex Mondragon-based but geographically community-oriented structure. And indeed, that's what's happening. That's the model that's beginning to emerge to begin to give stability both to the community and to the worker-owned companies, the worker-owned cooperatives in that area. And these are not small cooperatives. This is what can be done in any city. About 4 months ago, opened up the largest urban agricultural program in the United States, our largest urban greenhouse, 3 million heads of lettuce a year. To do that, I just learned you've got to plant 26,000 heads of lettuce every single day. It's a very powerful, large organization. There is, at this stage, an industrial-scale laundry, which uses about a third of the water and a third of the heat, very ecologically green in that area. And then there is a solar installation company that is online to put in as much solar installation as exists currently in the state of Ohio, linked into this complex, and they're hoping to do 1, 2 to 3 new ones each year. These are all developmental experiments. There are 10 other cities now on road to do something like this out of either a mayor who sees it or pressure from the bottom or innovation from another side, beginning to see that there is, and here's the point, in the emerging historical context, there is no other way forward. Either you do something new or the pain increases. And if you do it, all of a sudden the mayor has a powerful new base for job creation when he talks to the corporations who want the next bribe. He's got something building that he can do also, and he begins to use public resources to help you because it helps him. I could go on sketching that, but it is an emergent development that takes the notions we're talking about in a slightly different way, worker self-managed, but also related to a community-wide structure that builds community at the same time and begins to suggest some of the dimensions of what a decentralized planning system might involve, which also uses the market as a corrective. These are preliminary developments. That we can see them now and that they are viable in the United States is a critical understanding. And here's, Richard and I talked to each other about it, the time is now. This is the phrase. The time is now to begin to develop actual on-the-ground realities, actual conversations with Americans in language they can understand. They are open to understanding something new. They are open to developing new ways forward. We even find, and it's important to understand in these communities, so-called conservatives who don't, they're not the national ideologues. They don't know what it is, but they see these things and say, that's a great idea. The workers are working, they own it, that's a good idea. It helps the community, may even help the local market. The ideological patterns at the local level, go away from what you see on national television, are not set in stone. They are open to answers that are practical, democratic, productive and meaningful. Where all this could go, and my time must be getting 2 more minutes, where might all this go? There are three parts of this I want to mention. First, We are developing prototypes around the country and interest in the directions we're talking about, which, if advanced, begin to suggest, and here we totally agree, a different vision of socialism that is radically decentralized, but also builds up, I would contend, new structures that will help at the planning level. But right now, the main point is unless you do it from the ground up, you don't end up with a democratic solution, both within the workplace and in the communities. That is where we're building and developing and seeing ourselves. Here's where it gets existential, not systemic. Whether, and I am talking to the person in your seat, whether we actually can rise to the scale and say we actually are in the pre-revolutionary prehistory, which means that we actually begin to act and build and work and do the sort of things that Richard and I both are talking about and get on with it and talk to Americans as if they can actually hear. So that's a question to face personally. A lot of the left hasn't done that. It is time to drop that idea that they don't understand. Actually, given the pain levels, they understand a whole lot. What they're looking for, in my experience, is real answers rather than a lot of rhetoric. Nonetheless, what answers we give need to forecast and build towards a different, larger vision. There are two other parts of this. One, getting them on the ground also provides a political base. Labor as an institution has collapsed. These kinds of institutions, we agree, could become and are likely to become the new institutional base over time for the next politics, next left politics, if we are serious about them. And then there's a third place, and here I want to go to Gramsci, and here I want to go to people who have talked about the sociology of knowledge. There's been a whole literature of this in the Frankfurt School. What we are also about and needs to be self-aware and self-conscious, the creation of a new way of understanding to crack the hegemonic ideology. That's part and parcel what this is all about, showing breakthrough ways that you don't have to buy the old idea system, that there are idea systems that permit us to understand what's going on the ground, but offer ways forward in the realm of ideas, theory, and strategy that crack the old nonsense. So self-consciously building the institutions in order to have a democratic system rather than a statist system is critical. We are totally in accord. Beginning to understand more complexity, I would urge, is very important. Beginning to use and build these institutions as part of the next power base is a second element. But also seeing it self-consciously and with full awareness as a way to crack the ideology and begin substituting a truly democratic vision of the next transformation. Thank you very much.
So let's open it up to questions. Maybe we could take three or four questions and... Go ahead.
Hi. Hello. Hi. Michael Yellow, the chair of the Green Party in New York State. Wondering what kind of laws, reforms, tax coaching is expected to be implemented to facilitate the creation and maintenance of worker self-directed enterprises. How can we make it easier at every level, from local to county, state, that candidates can campaign on? Will continue to people with this
comment on if you may agree or disagree, that is, this alpha male kind of dynamic female as well, that in the wild and in the mammalian species is the strongest survival for this where you fight and kill, has been transferred to the legal system of the dollar, where it's the strongest people that under which the rest of us live that have to work for a living.
Thank you. And maybe just try to keep the questions a little bit brief.
Okay. My name is Odi Lumanovimba, and I'm from Ann Arbor, Michigan. I guess what my question is, I remember in France we had a big factory that converted into a worker-owned factory. But what happened is that we live in predatory capitalism, and how can those workers-owned cooperatives can compete with this predatory capitalism and survive? I guess we have to convince our community not to go to Walmart and for people to buy local, but when their wage disappears, then what are they going to do? So it's kind of the question that I have. And in Detroit right now, we have a group of people who are trying to form a worker-owned cooperative for nursing aides and also for hospices. So do you have such example anywhere in the country where medical people are forming their own worker cooperatives? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi. I was wondering, is it possible to integrate into the bottom-up workplace for lack of a better term, a top-down national public planning model, because I think we face an ecological crisis of various kinds, and we need national systems like national high-speed rail, national wind, national agriculture, all kinds of policies we need in order to avoid the worst of global warming and other ecological situations. So is it possible to have a national planning process that allows us to regenerate our infrastructure at the same time that we have this bottom-up democratization of the economy?
Thank you. Sorry, let me take just one from that side, and then we'll, because I didn't see you guys, sorry.
Quickly to the French woman who just spoke, you should check out the Cooperative Home Care Associates here in the Bronx. They're a large example of what you're talking about. And to GAR, specifically, I was wondering if you could talk, using very concrete examples from the experience in Cleveland, about the tension between workplace democracy and community accountability, because I think that you guys laid out very clearly the economic rationale and cultural and political rationale for worker cooperatives, but the issue also is the ecological fact that we're destroying the earth. And so how do we address that, and how do we address the fact that workers in the oil sector or in the auto sector may actually economically redistribute the products of their labor in a very desirable way, but we might actually engage in production that is socially harmful. And that raises a lot of questions about the extent to which what the tension is between the democracy that exists in the workplace, their accountability to the community. And it also raises the issue when you're discussing this example of Cleveland, to what extent is this network that you're discussing replacing the market as a method of distribution, because we all know the extent to which the market constrains alternative experiments and workplace organizing. So what extent does creating these community structures constrain the ability for workers to make decisions in their unit?
Thanks.
By going first, I have the pleasure of picking which part I want to answer and leave to GAR all the rest. Can you all hear? Okay, good. Let me deal with the first one about laws or practical legal arrangements that one might campaign for, say, in a political electoral sense, that would help. I think that's a very important issue. It's one of many ways to move this project forward. And I think there's an endless array of new laws or revisions of existing laws in the United States, for example, that could help this process along, and that it is absolutely something that Green parties and all other parties that are interested in this sort of thing can do. Some have already done them. And let me mention a couple of things that have always struck me as interesting. One of the first things this movement needs to do, and I haven't done it yet, and maybe Gar knows if someone has, is to do a systematic survey of other advanced industrial countries, and perhaps all countries, as to what in fact exists in the way of really cooperative enterprises in general, or worker co-ops in particular would be my interest, to see what the actual history of these kinds of businesses is, what has proven to help them develop, what have been major obstacles, obviously the kind of lesson we would all benefit from. I've done a little of that, and one of the earliest laws I came across is what I'm going to tell you about now. But just as an example, this is 1985 in Italy, and the Italian Parliament passes something called the Marcora Law, I believe named after a representative, a politician named Marcora. And what it basically does in Italy, since 1985, so they've had now quite a long history of experiments with it, is it gives unemployed people in Italy an option they do not have in the United States. Here's how it works, roughly. When you become unemployed, you can go on the dole for a year or two, pretty much like we do here in the United States. You go get your check every week, you're unemployed, and then eventually it runs out, and you hope that you find a job before that happens. In Italy, they offer that as option A, but they offer an option B. And here's that option. The government of Italy will give you your entire year or two worth of weekly payments up front as a lump sum on the following two conditions. One, you get at least, I believe it's 9 or 10 other unemployed workers to make the same choice. And, second condition, all of that money must be pooled by this group of at least 10 or 11 or however many more it might be, to be used as the startup capital of a cooperative enterprise. What an interesting idea. Works pretty well in Italy. Has helped to found all manner of co-ops. Some of them have survived, some not. But if the idea is you don't have people sitting for long periods of time unemployed with all of the effects on their self-esteem, their mental and physical health, number two, you give them an incentive to make this new enterprise work because it's their own money and they can't go back on unemployment if it doesn't work out, etc. What an interesting way for the government, without using more money than they would have given that unemployed person, but to do something that is better for that person, doesn't cost the government more, and is wrapped up with the co-op enterprise idea. And by the way, you might be interested in one of the key rationales. For the United States that believes in quote-unquote freedom of choice, here's what this law would need as a defense. Americans ought to have freedom of choice to work in a top-down, hierarchical, capitalist enterprise, if they wish, or in a democratic, collective, self-directed enterprise, if they so prefer. But in order to be able to have such a freedom of choice, you have to have such enterprises for them to go work in. And what would be a more useful social service for the government to perform than to help develop such enterprises? And why not use the unemployment catastrophe as a way to help people with an enormous incentive to try to do that? And to provide them, of course, with the technical and other kinds of assistance to help get that going. In the interest of time, one other example, and I'll answer one of the other questions. We have in the United States a small business administration. We have all kinds of minority business administrations and programs. We already, as a matter of national policy, support some kinds of enterprises with preferential interest rates, so they get low interest credit, with all kinds of technical assistance, with all kinds of supports, even with government contracts, if they are something we deem useful. Minority businesses, small businesses. Well, what in the world prevents us from having a cooperative business administration, precisely to give the American people the benefit of that choice by helping to develop those and doing it on a national basis? So you could do that on a state level, you could do it on a, you could even do it on a large city level, you can certainly do it on a national level. It's, these are examples of legal changes that could be made and that ought to be made. Competition. let me deal with that one and leave other things to Gar. It is a misreading of economics. I say that as a professor of economics. Not that that means you should listen to me 1 minute more than you would if I weren't one, but it sometimes helps. This is a country in which expertise is valued in ways that have always mystified me, so let me cash in on that. I'm an economist. Competition means that if somebody else is offering a product at a price lower than yours, you're in trouble. I could take 10 hours to give you the idea, but that's it. That's really it. If someone manages to cut their price in some way, Gar's example, by polluting or something else, good. But you always have all manner of ways of responding to that kind of competition. It is a joke of the propaganda of our business community that wants you to believe that there is only one way. The typical preference of corporations is there's only one way to solve competition, and that is to lower wages. Hello? There are lots of costs that go into the price of anything. You can cut any one of those, and it'll drop the price. Here's a thought. Drop the key executives from $10 million pay packages to $150,000. It'll allow you to drop the price really nicely. That would be a clever way of competing with somebody else who's polluting. You do not, in fact, have to pollute. One of the results we know historically is if you constrain the ability of capitalists to compete by dropping their wages, they focus their competitive strategies somewhere else, like improving technology, finding cheaper inputs. All businesses will tell you this. There's always 27 things you can do. You can't do them all, but you go where you can. Monopolies are developed in the United States. Our history is full of it, by companies deciding that they're not going to compete on the level of price. So they compete somewhere else. Hello? We even prevent companies from certain kinds of competition, despite their argument that it was essential. 100 years ago, we prevented businesses in America from hiring children. Children was effective. It was a good competition. You got away with paying much less, and you could drop your price. It was terrible for business not to be able to use cheap children. We made a decision as a society. You can compete. You can do whatever you want, but children, can't do it. Well, suppose we said you can't cut wages. You can't compete in the ways that are important for a co-op. That would be called leveling the playing field so that the co-op has certain kinds of advantages, and you can't do as a capitalist industry what you want to do if it undermines the co-op. And what would enable that to happen? Gar's point. Building the co-ops as a political base for the left. At a time when the left can grow but is looking for a political base, what a remarkable thing if that could be worked out as a way forward. Now let me...
So let me just add to what Richard said about the laws that are available. One of the things we've discovered in working in places like Cleveland, it's amazing that we discovered it. We just sort of looked, and everybody can look. The American business community has developed dozens and dozens of special deals that help businesses. A co-op is a business. There are many things, technical assistance, indirect tax boost, land acquisition, enormous number of things available currently in the United States tax code and legislation that are available to any business if you can get the political support from it. It usually requires the mayor to help you. And the mayor begins to look good. So that's one thing not to ignore, that you can do a lot right now. I totally agree there are many other steps you could make special. There is a co-op bank. Footnote. Most people, you know, you talk about socialized banks and public banks as an idea, very radical idea. Most people don't know that there are 140 public banks within the federal government today. They're not all called public banks. Some of them are the Export-Import Bank to help corporations export and import. The Co-op Bank is another one that uses that name. But throughout the agricultural sector, for instance, there are special banks that help different parts of agriculture. There are so many precedents to build upon, and this side for the finance side of what we're talking about, it's unimaginable. And we haven't looked at the, here's a job for those of you who are interested in this. We haven't looked at all the available supports existing now in public policy that can be transformed and used in addition to the steps forward, like the Marcora law that could be added, et cetera. That there is a panoply of things that can be done and should be done. A lot of them developed out of the agricultural cooperative political movement of the 1930s, where there are places to look for other ways to expand. And still one more point to mention. The current law, put together by a maverick corporate guy who saw how his own corporate leaders were making money, and Huey Long's son, who happened to be chairman of the Senate Finance Committee in the early 1970s, provides very large incentives for people who retire and sell their company to the workers. Mostly this has been set up under the so-called ESOP form. We could get into that. It's too complicated. It also permits selling to worker co-ops. Now, a little light bulb ought to go on here. Over the next decade, several million people who are the baby boom people will retire, and they're going to have to get rid of their companies. And if their kids don't want them, their choice is to sell to a big corporation without the incentives or sell to the workers with the incentives. There is an enormous possibility here that we haven't even addressed if you want to begin to transfer and build ownership structures. And if you look carefully, begin to dig, there are numerous possibilities of this kind that you can already use or build upon. So that has to do with the legal question. I do want to talk a little bit about this community, the question about oil companies and auto companies. There is a problem which we haven't confronted, you know, and you can exaggerate this, so I'm doing this as an exaggerated form. If you're the workers who own the oil industry, you may be in a different political position than the workers who own the garbage industry. It isn't necessarily the case that worker-owned companies in a free market will produce an egalitarian society. So the question becomes, and that's why these framework issues become very important and why I have been urging and stressing to the degree possible community-wide structures, to the degree possible, whether at the local level, the national level, the national community, the state level, or probably in a continental system like the United States, the regional level. Incidentally, they're trying to sell off the Tennessee Valley Authority. Some good, some bad, and the Republicans are against it. Why? Because everybody loves this socialized enterprise in the Tennessee Valley, the largest utility in the country. The Obama administration is trying to sell it off because it'll make their budget look a little better. So there are many precedents to look for, but let me stress this one. In a community-wide structure, to the degree, and in Cleveland this is similar, to the degree you pollute, you actually pollute your own community. So internalizing that externality is one step in the argument. And here's another one which is a little more subtle, but I think even more important. Ultimately, the system that I think we will create will involve a fair amount of public activity, which in one form or another involves economic planning, whether you call it that or not. The Marcora law is one of those. What are the criteria generated by actual experience that give guidance and set the parameters of whatever economic national policy we have? What are the criteria that create that? You can't just hope, certainly anybody studying political economy and history says, you can't just hope we can paste on regulatory strategies on the system. One of the questions is whether the actual experience of people in everyday life builds a cultural political experience that the community as a whole has an interest in ecological issues, and that set of cultural developments becomes the nurturing ground, the hothouse in which a culture of ecological sustainability gets built so that it can inform and not lose power at the national planning level or the regional planning level or the state planning. Without that, there is an incentive for workers to pollute if the next worker-owned company across the state pollutes as well. Unless you can get that somehow arranged, you're in trouble in any system. So building the culture that will sustain and nurture the larger criteria, whether they're called laws or planning system, I think becomes a critical element in all this. And that goes to the French question that was also asked, because we are talking, I think, when we build up from where we now are. And let's talk about it in phases. Right now, we're getting things on the ground. We're getting ideas going. We're getting people understanding this. We're trying to build a movement that builds. That's a major step for the next decade and well beyond, the next couple decades. There are next steps beyond that involve these kinds of policies and planning when there's enough political support for them. And at that level, I think we're going to be needing capacities so that when one company actually shuts down, you can transform to another. So what would be an example? If you had, you know, national money, taxpayer money is going to support it all for rail systems, as I said earlier, and mass transit. If the auto industry goes down as it should, there would be a capacity actually to target new jobs in from the public sector in a different planning modality. That's your only ultimate answer to the question of the woman from France raised. But that is a step down the line. And then the question becomes whether in our developmental work ourselves, and this is critical for us now, that we are beginning to theorize and plan and look for experiments and developing experiments at the state and local level that gives us enough solid understanding and information so we can then, in fact, implement them as time goes on.
So I know we are really short on time, so we're going to do a lightning quick two responses with two questions left. One from the gentleman over here and one from the gentleman over here. Please, go ahead.
Okay, very briefly. This is very informative and exciting. I just have one thing that I want to add. This also relates to the question about tax incentives. Professor Wolf talked about the micro and macro. I think there's also an intermediate scale, and that pertains to big corporations. I have proposed in a recent book a tax incentive that would promote worker ownership and control of big corporations. It's very simple. You take the corporate income tax, and instead of paying it to the government, you create worker equity. So instead of a third profits going to the government, a third of the equity will go to the workers. And that would end up with maybe workers having three members on the board, as well as some equity.
Thank you.
Just a question about finance.
So a minute each, maybe?
I want to deal again with this question of the competition. The Mondragon experience of 50 years does show the crucial nature of helping one another. So that's this point that co-ops, once you get going, and we arguably already have enough of that in the United States to begin to create the networks among them so they can help each other. Mondragon, for example, moves people who are not needed in one enterprise over into jobs. One of the reasons they are able to guarantee job security in a way that capitalist enterprises cannot do, because of the network within the co-op movement of that kind of flexibility. And so, yes, of course the co-ops would help. One of the projects I'm working on is to develop a kind of Craigslist in which all of you that might want to be supportive of a co-op will have a place to go on the internet, and instead of buying where you were about to buy from anything else, you will be given a complete menu of every co-op in the United States, whatever it's producing, all the conditions under which it's producing, so you can go there and buy. The same Craigslist will say, if you want a job in a co-op, here's the 84 co-ops around the country that are looking to hire. And if you want to start a co-op, here are 47 other people who have indicated on this website that they are also, in this part of the country, interested in starting a co-op. In other words, this kind of connection, which the internet actually facilitates, is part of how this process is getting going. Yep, last comment about community involvement on the broader issue. Germany in the 1920s, the so-called Weimar Republic, organized a parliament in a different way. instead of there being a House of Representatives and a Senate or the equivalent of that, they had one kind of legislative house being drawn by people who vote in a neighborhood where they reside, the way we do. But the other parliament was composed of people voting from the workplace where they were employed, so that you had to have both houses agree on legislation, but the legislation had to reflect the interests of the residential community on the one hand and the labor community on the other. If you want to know how democratically self-directed worker enterprises would have to function, they would have to be codependent, interdependent, and co-respective with the communities impacted. Otherwise, you don't have democracy, since a corporate a business decision impacts the residential community and vice versa. There has to be the co-decision by your identity as a resident, but your other identity as a working director of enterprises, in order to make a genuine democracy be respective of the interests of a community that are not identical with the interests of a work collective.
So that I love that last example, because it is one of the many different ways that, if you see this period as critical to the developmental of the next vision, developing the next vision, you will begin to look for that kind of model. That's one way to balance community and worker-owned issues. The Cleveland model is another one. There are a range of things that people who actually roll up their sleeves and get into doing this, as well as theorizing about it, I think are going to get a proliferation of trying to work out these things. And I love the Craigslist idea. That's a great idea. But what's happening, I go around the country. Rick has been doing far more of this, but I've been going around the country. Almost every place I go, 10 people come up to me afterward with something new that I'd never heard of that's going on that is in this different realm of discussion. So the one thing I want to pick up and talk about just a little bit more in terms of one of the questions here is why it is critical, in my view, to begin understanding the broad movement that's going on, that is the community ownership, the land trust, the public utilities. 350 utilities, cities now are capturing methane from the garbage, turning it into electricity, and setting up public companies to do that, the public banks, the things that are going on, the land trust, that are going on in various realms that are all associated with democratizing capital. They are also critical elements in, sometimes the language is the new economy, building a power base, and that we need to have a broader vision to build a power base to achieve this goal. And what one way to symbolize that and why I want to stress it in closing is this. If you look at the best examples we have so far of worker self-management and worker ownership are Mondragon on the one hand and the Emilia-Romagna co-ops in Italy and the other co-ops in Italy on the other hand. That's the ones we look at. They both came out of very unique experiences, both of them partly because the local culture was highly repressed, on the one hand by Franco's destruction of the Basque people, if he could, and by Mussolini's attack, fascism's attack on that part of the red belt of largely communist in Italy, very special conditions that produced them, which we hopefully don't replicate. But even more, and it's really interesting to see, even so, though these are the best models, in the Basque country, Mondragon only employs less than 4% of the population, and in Spain as a whole, 1.3% of the population. And all of the co-ops in Italy have only achieved 6% of the population, and we're talking in the 6% of the population in the Emilia-Romagna regions, and less than 3% nationally in Italy. So either we find a way to build a broader movement, or possibly to do better than these particular models that everyone points to, or I think we're going to be marginalized. So I'm urging that we understand democratizing ownership in a broader political sense as a way both to build allies, but also to begin to develop it in the Gramscian sense, some understanding that instead of the 400 people, every time I say this, this number stops me cold, 400 people, you could get them into a large airplane, have more wealth in the United States than the bottom 180 million taken together. Either we democratize capital or they continue to run the game. Thank you.
So that concludes our panel. Please join me in thanking Rick and Gar for a great panel.
Thanks for listening to the Gar Alpervitz podcast. To find articles, interviews, audio, video, and more, go to www.americabeyondcapitalism.com.